my brain was formed in trauma. And that's not something I'm ashamed of. It's something that my life went through.
I am your host, Zach Weaver, and this is Made Us. I had an incredible conversation this week with the one and only Kelly Dezik. Now, some of my listeners may already know that name, and some of you may not. But after today's episode, you won't forget it. Kelly and I talk about a lot of things, really. But the biggest topic we talk about is Kelly's life growing up within a cult. This conversation went some places that I didn't think it would go, but I'm really happy it did. This is a heavy subject, but one I was really happy to tackle with her. And of course, it's got its lighthearted moments, and we talk about her new upcoming podcast, Relatively Unscathed. And if you like this episode of Made Us, or any episode of Made Us, go into Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star rate and review, and let us know how we're doing. Also, make sure to hit that subscribe button so you don't miss a single episode of Made Us. And if you don't subscribe in Apple Podcasts, subscribe in whatever your favorite podcast app is. And if you want to keep up with us on social media, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/madeuspodcast or on Instagram and Twitter at madeuspodcast. And if you have a guest suggestion or any comments about the show, feel free to email us at madeuspodcast@hotmail.com. So I can't tell you guys how much I enjoy being back in the studio and bringing you more interviews. And today's episode really was a powerful one and one I really enjoyed myself. Today's episode is going to have moments that'll make you cry and moments that'll make you laugh. But after today's episode, you're going to be aware. And if you're listening to this on the day that's released, it's Happy 4th of July, Independence Day. And that's quite a coincidence because the topic we talk about today is really about gaining your independence again. This was a great conversation, and I hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Kelly Dezik. Kelly, thank you for joining me tonight.
Thank you very much.
I'm happy to have you here. Thanks for making the drive down.
No problem.
So for my listeners that haven't heard yet, Kelly has been on an episode of Truth and Justice, which is recorded out of the same studio. And when you made the trip down for that, you drove down in a blizzard. And tonight on your way down, we had a freak thunderstorm, which was absolute downpour. So you're just getting shit on the way down.
It's okay, though. You know, it was a little bit crazy the first time we came out. But this time, you know, you get used to that rain and there was some good music. And like you said, there was a rainbow at the end. So,
and like you said, it's Michigan.
It is. And it's a straight shot across 94.
Yeah,
so
we kind of get used to it here.
Any kind of weather is what you get used to in Michigan.
That's for sure. That's the old thing I always used to hear is if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes because it'll change.
Absolutely. It's the damn truth. So.
So, Kelly, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name's Kelly Dezik. Like Zach said, I was on an episode of Truth and Justice where I talked a little bit about how traumatic memory works. It was this recent season. To be honest, I told Zach, I actually haven't listened to the episode that I'm on because I don't know, it's a weird thing with me. I don't like listening to my voice recorded. I got to get over that, I think. I talked a little bit about some of my experiences, including growing up in a religious cult and working in a forensic capacity during my time as a psychologist, because I've done a lot of assessments throughout my career that's kind of, and trauma-formed and informed assessments. So we're here to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
That's awesome. So what are you currently doing?
Well, right now I'm kind of pretty much transitioning out, if I can completely, hopefully, of doing assessments directly with clients. I love it. I'm good at it, but there's a lot of reasons.
And what kind of assessments are these?
Well, I do every kind of assessment. I didn't originally go to school to be a psychologist. I actually originally went to school to be a journalist.
Oh, nice.
And then I worked a little bit in public relations.
Okay.
Didn't love it. And then September 11th happened. I got laid off. And then I started volunteering at a suicide helpline and kind of got a little push from some people there that I might enjoy being a psychologist, might be good at it. Went back to get my master's degree and then kind of fell in to doing assessments.
Yeah.
So anything from a psychosocial or diagnostic assessment, which is what you go, if you go into any psychologist or any mental health care provider, they're going to usually meet with you for about an hour and talk to you about what's going on. And then they have to give you a provisional diagnosis, blah, blah, blah. But the thing that I do that some psychologists and some social workers don't do is things like IQ testing, testing for ADHD, things like pretty much anything that's in the diagnostic manual, you can do some sort of testing for. And
okay.
then I kind of moved towards the end of my career into doing more forensically basic assessments, like things like criminal responsibility, culpability, competency, you know, all those testing things that you hear on true crime podcasts.
Okay.
But I have some chronic health issues, and I also just decided that I wanted to work for myself.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be starting a podcast, kind of in the works right now.
Nice. What's it going to be called?
Relatively Unscathed.
Relatively Unscathed.
It's a joke that I usually make because I have a pretty dark sense of humor when I'm with my friends. You know, people kind of hear things that I've gone through, and I always say that we all go through really, really hard shit in life.
Absolutely.
At different things, but the best we can do is try to get out relatively unscathed.
Absolutely. You know, and that was a big part of me making this podcast is I've been through a lot. I've seen a lot. I have seen a lot of things that I don't like to remember, but I do. And everything, every one of those has made me a stronger person. And that's where I came up with this idea is everybody has a story to share and all these stories can help somebody. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to, I share mine as much as I can. I haven't shared mine a lot on here yet because this, I'm trying to share everybody else's stories.
Sure.
But it is about trying to help people. And that sounds like what you have too, is everybody has this past, you know, you come out relatively unscathed from it. Mm-hmm. And that's where I went too, is like, you know, these are the stories that made us, which is where I came up with Made Us.
Yeah. And that's part, you know, I think there's a lot of similarities between what you're doing, sort of what Bob was doing on I'm the Storm and what I'm hoping to do with Relatively Unscathed, which is, you know, primarily I want to raise awareness about what PTSD is, what it looks like, because I think that our whole society could be improved by having more knowledge about the impact of trauma. And I feel like the only way that we can kind of boost the profile of trauma-informed care across the board is for people to be honest about what they've been through if they're in a place that they can do
absolutely
that mentally. So
absolutely.
That's what I'm trying to do.
No, it makes perfect sense. And I think it's a really awesome cause. And I'm happy you're doing it because I think there's more people that need to be doing things like this and kind of putting yourself out there because, it is hard to open up about your past. And I say you, I don't necessarily mean your, just like the overall your past, but it can really help people.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing is, you know, I've had a couple different guests that have come on and talked about PTSD and how it's affected them. And I think that's a big thing. And I'm really happy that you're opening up to it.
Yeah. It's something that, you know, interestingly enough, one of the most destructive emotions is shame and guilt. And I've never been somebody who's been super ashamed about things I've gone through or super reserved.
Yeah.
But I am sort of a private person, just that I don't like to tell people my business a lot. But what I learned, and honestly, I learned this from my clients when I was doing my teenagers.
Yeah.
Because I love working with teenagers. They're amazing. Is that if you are willing to share a little bit with somebody who's very different than you, looks different, has had a different background, sometimes they realize you're not all that different.
Absolutely.
And also it can really help them feel less alone and help them be more open to working on things they need to, or to healing or to moving forward in life. So
yeah,
that's what I'm hoping to do anyway.
That's awesome.
And it's going to be an interview show. It's not going to be all just me talking.
That's rough to just talk by yourself.
I talk to myself all the time, but y'all don't want to hear me talking to myself. That's mostly swearing under my breath at people.
Yeah, I could see that. So. No, the shame is a big thing. You know, for me, I think a lot of mine is not necessarily shame. Mm-hmm. I don't have shame in my past. Mm-hmm. Mine is more that I'm still deeply connected to some of these people.
Yeah.
And I'm more worried about hurting them, even though times have changed. Things have changed. The people that have affected me have changed drastically. Yeah. And that's my biggest concern is hurting them. Mm-hmm. I'm through it. I feel like I'm a better person. It wasn't always easy. It wasn't always fun. I fought a lot through it. I had a lot of mental hurdles that I had to clear myself. You know, I don't know if I said this before on the podcast, but when I started getting tattooed, I got tattooed because I didn't like who I was. And I wanted to change who I was. Mm-hmm. And that was a big step for me. And it eventually got past that. You know, I love my tattoos. That's not, you know, it's different now. But when I started getting tattooed, it was to change the person that I was. Yeah. Not necessarily that I didn't like who I had become. It was more like I just had so much built up that I didn't know how to handle it. And I didn't want to be me anymore.
Yeah.
And then the people that kind of put me through some of that have changed drastically too. They've matured, they've grown up. And that's my biggest concern, is hurting them.
And I mean, that's something that, you know, I'm not struggling with myself. I've actually been doing a lot of, you know, a lot of my family is still alive. All my parents, my mom, my stepdad, my real dad, you know, a lot of my family are still here and they're part of the story. And, you know, some of them are at different places in their own healing process. Some of them, you know, don't have any interest in ever talking about things. But what I like to tell people when I was doing therapy regularly was, it's your story.
Yeah.
No one else has a right to your story. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to, if you love people, you don't want to hurt them.
Absolutely.
By telling your story. I just choose, because of some things I've been through where I was told to basically be quiet, be submissive, be small.
Yeah.
You know, those are things that I feel like now I'm ready to kind of talk a little bit and hopefully encourage other people to do that too.
So. That's good. So let's dive into that if you don't mind.
All right.
So for the listeners, we talked about it already, but mm-hmm. you were in a religious cult.
Yes, I was. It is called The Way International. It is a group that is still around. It is much, much, much smaller than it used to be.
Okay.
I grew up in the group. I was born into the group, and okay. I pretty much left more or less when I was 17.
Yeah. That's hard when you're born into it, because you mm-hmm. don't know another way.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, it's one thing. I guess I say it. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to be coerced into joining. It's one thing to be brought into yourself. But when you're born into it, you don't really know anything different.
Exactly. And it's funny that you say that word coerced. And, you know, I'm going to bring up some buzzwords when we're talking, things like coercive control and undue influence. And there are things that, if you want to learn more about cults, you can just give it a Google and yeah. They'll bring you to some good research and some good sites. And, you know, if Zach wants more information, we can put it in, you know, the description. But
absolutely.
Basically, you know, my mom has different feelings about the cult than I do, because she did choose it. She knows now that it was a cult.
Yeah.
But when I was growing up and struggling, especially when I was a teenager, didn't really want to be part of it and kind of saw through the bullshit, as many teenagers do in life.
Yeah.
As difficult as they are to be around sometimes. You know, at that time, she was still 100% in with both feet. And
oh,
so
really?
It's been kind of an evolution for my whole family, sort of growing up. Because my mom was only 20 when she had me. She was a kid. She was in a terrible situation with my real dad. To make it quick, she left an incredibly abusive relationship that probably would have killed her and possibly could have hurt me and my brother
yeah.
badly. And the way she got out of it was the family of that religious group.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I don't have the experience that you do. Mm-hmm. Just from my understanding, is I feel like those groups almost prey on those people, because they are looking for somebody. They're looking for somebody to help them. Mm-hmm. And your mother coming out of a situation like that, she's looking for somebody to quote unquote save her. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden there's this group of people ready to save her.
Yeah. And the crazy story, because it's really funny, because my mom my mom's gone through some real stressful situations in the last year, 2 years. And so I've been talking to her much more as an adult to try to help her, to try to help myself understand. And we just recently had like a 2-hour conversation where I almost interviewed her about some things I didn't know. And like why she joined the group.
Yeah.
And it was crazy when you say that sort of recruiting, you know, whatever word we use to describe it, the reason she joined the group was because my real dad and his group of buddies were, you know, whatever word you want to describe it, criminals, thugs. My dad was a master thief.
Oh, geez.
My dad also had an incredibly traumatic childhood. And it's, you know, maybe some other time to go into that on an episode of Relatively Unscathed. But I mean, as in, oldest sister had to take care of the kids when she was a teenager because mom and dad weren't around, you know, alcoholism, trauma, separation. He spent time in a boys' home in Oklahoma. He has wonderful qualities too. He
yeah.
can be very charismatic. That's a choice. He can be loving, you know, but I didn't really grow up with him because she left when I was 5.
Okay.
And my contact with him has been very sporadic since then. My brother still has contact with him. And I mean, I have a picture of him on my
yeah.
phone. But I think I got off track. But basically, she joined the group because one of their buddies got put in prison for a few years for, I believe, if I remember correctly, blowing up a police car.
Holy shit.
And when he was in prison, you know, my mom was around these people, but she wasn't, you know, she was kind of a, she loved my dad, and she was trying to, you know, get out of some stuff that was going on in her house. And she's not naive, but she's got this big open heart for people. And so she saw this guy have this huge transition when he was in prison. And she asked what happened. And then he introduced her to the group because the group did outreach in prisons.
Okay.
So it's good and bad. I think groups like this can become a problem because of the people who are in the leadership positions.
You know, and that's, I'm going to say this, and this is going to come off sounding really bad at the beginning. and I genuinely don't mean it, but if you genuinely look into what I'm about to say, it makes sense. If you look at some of these cults, some of them really at the beginning really do amazing work.
Oh, yeah.
This is one that's going to fuck a lot of people up. Is look at the People's Temple. At the beginning, Jim Jones did a lot of good things. Mm-hmm. And then it spun out of control. Yeah. I am not by any means saying Jim Jones was a good person or what, you know what I mean? Clearly what he did was a disaster. I mean, it was horrendous.
He murdered people and he convinced people to murder themselves. Yes,
900 people. Mm-hmm. But at the beginning of that, he really did a lot of good work. Mm-hmm. Which is what drew those people in, which is sad to say. And I'm, you know, by any means, I'm not saying it's awesome, but like you said, this group is doing outreach to these prisoners, and it's probably at a certain point was genuine and was trying to help.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not going to go, if you guys want to learn more specifically about the group I was in, there's a Wikipedia page that's pretty good. There is actually a 2-part Parcast Cults, whatever the hell it's called. They did a pretty good 2-parter on it. But
what's the name of it again?
The group is called the Way, called the Way International. The Way is usually what we called it. The Ministry. It had lots of names. Okay. The Way International is, I think, probably what they were registered are with the government for tax purposes. But anyways.
Yeah.
And like I said, they still do exist. And I'm going to preface all of this with saying, and I think I said it before, cults can exist outside of religious groups too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're really about a continuum of influence. And if you look at, if you want to look online and do some research, there's a man named Steve Hassan, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. He's a former cult member, and he does a lot of things and a lot of academic research, and he does a lot of books and things. So,
okay.
But what you were saying about how they do so much good at first, you know, a lot of, like, the man who started the group that I was in, and there were two main leaders, one after the first guy died, and he was an evangelical Baptist type preacher, okay. And then he kind of split off, and he went out to San Francisco. He did, you know, he was kind of a hippie in some ways,
yeah.
And many of the people that were in the group when I grew up, which would be pretty much the 80s and 90s, 78 is when I was born. They were artists, hippies, people who wanted a family, people who felt like throwaways. And I'm not going to say by any means that all my experiences were bad. I mean, there are things that I learned in that group, things that I love to this day that I got my start doing in that group. But the problem is that the group itself, by merits of how it was structured, was malignant and an environment where bad things could happen and where people's free will kind of gets ground down. And that's because the people who are structuring the rules in the group aren't doing it for the purposes that they say they're doing it for.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. That really is a tough bind because, like you said, you know, not all your experiences are bad, but clearly, you know, there's issues there.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, because it was a religious group too, my mom grew up Catholic and some stuff actually happened within that structure and her family, some betrayals, some hard, horrible things. And so she was searching. My mom's one of those people who loves to learn and she's a searcher. She loves it. And so she was out searching. And I think, you know, part of it was she was with my dad and then things got real bad with him. He was very violent with her. And of course, that's where some of my PTSD symptoms come from. But then she went and found this group where she thought she was able to have her faith, which is very important to her.
Okay.
And also have, you know, people that helped her, people that loved her. Not that her family didn't. They always did. But, you know, it was something that she was searching for inside. And I think she got a lot of good things out of it. But because of how sneaky, and I don't know if that's the right word, some of these groups are psychologically,
yeah,
it just ends up being this yucky environment that, you know. And I, you know, some people don't have terrible experiences, but I'm always on guard for situations like that. So
being born into this, you're born, you're a child, you're going up. Did you know things were different? I mean, you know, because at what point did you know things were different?
Well, let's see. Like I said, this group was pretty financially successful. Okay. So
let me stop you right there for a second. What was their financial interest? Like,
how did they make their money?
Yeah.
Okay. A couple things. One is that there was a class that you had, basically there were classes that you had to take if you wanted to kind of quote unquote move up in the hierarchy of the group.
So a general like Scientology
kind of. It was called the PFAL class. I mean, like I said, Wikipedia, I'm sure you can find the actual book online somewhere, but they had many structured classes, and you had to have the privilege of moving up to the intermediate, advanced, blah, 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 and a bunch of other classes. To be frank, they were also pretty damn, preachy about tithing.
Okay.
10% of your income.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because, you know, that was something they preached pretty hardcore about. And that's, you know, that an undue influence. These are grown adults in this religious group who are getting preached at. And when I say preached, I mean like sermon, not like rah, about their finances, how they raise their kids, how they present themselves. You know, there were just endless things. And so they made their money through that, through the classes, through tithing. You know, it's a church, so they're not real transparent with their finances. All I know is that, like, they expected you, and when I say you, I mean the adults in the group, to be very flexible to the needs and the structure of the group. For instance, we moved frequently because my mom would go out on assignments. And then we also lived for 2 years at one of their core campuses.
Okay.
Which I kind of describe it as a commune. It's the best way to describe it. But it's almost like a little tiny college campus too.
Okay.
And then they sent us somewhere else and then somewhere else. So it's like there's this overwhelming influence in your life, and including it up your nose, up your butt, in your finances. I mean, they want to know how you're spending your money, whether your mortgage is paid off, if you have any debt. I mean, things like that. They were real bad about debt. They were like, it's bad. So
yeah,
I don't know.
No, it seems like that's a lot of cults. If you haven't figured out, I have a big fascination with cults. I've researched a lot of cults. I've studied a lot of cults. And that's a big thing with cults is they want you to give up your possessions. They want you to give up your properties. They want you to give, you know, you said 10% tithing, which is still, I mean, that's a big deal, 10% tithing. But there are definitely other groups that are like everything.
Well, yeah.
And we'll control your finances.
And, you know, and I was a kid, but I've had a lot of conversations with my mom. And I think the way things are structured, like, for instance, just it creates instability when you're sent out to new locations every year to do outreach and ministry, because that's why we move so much.
Okay.
And then when my mom and I and my brother, this was before she remarried, went to live on that campus for 2 years, she wasn't allowed to work.
Yeah.
So I got pneumonia while I was there. When I asked my mom the other day, I'm like, we didn't have insurance. There was no to government assistance. So she wasn't, and my mom worked like hell before we went there. She was cleaned houses, scrubbed toilets, waited tables. When we got there, she wasn't allowed to earn any money. So it's this situation where it's almost an enforced dependence on the group. And then you don't get to make decisions. Now, I never felt, we didn't have a lot of money growing up until my mom remarried. But I never felt deprived either. Now, looking back and realizing that there were some things that, you know, I have my own child and I don't know if I could do that.
Yeah.
Just the uncertainty that always existed in our life. But in some ways, we were very well provided for because it was a group. And so if we needed something, somebody would pitch in. Because, you know, the people who were not in the leadership, a lot of times just depended on each other, loved each other, took care of each other. In some ways, it was a village that raised a child or children. So
And the group members, like you said, they genuinely care for each other.
Some of them.
Well, yeah. You're going to have those people that don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's where the good part comes is you have these people that that are really believing what's being preached, and they believe that you need to help each other.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that's so hard, you know, and I don't, you know, whenever people ask about my growing up the way I did, it's almost one of those conversations that takes hours to go through all the layers, but like, and why I say, and I try to push so much that cults can exist in a lot of different places is because when you put in like these faith, this religion, like morality, things that people base their lives on, and then layer on top of it these sociological things, these psychological tools, these manipulation, this coercive control and things, it becomes this clusterfuck, frankly, of confusion.
Yeah.
You know, my mom was real young. She enjoyed, you know, the fun things they did, you know, all of the festivals, because every year they had this great big festival in New Knoxville, Ohio,
okay,
where, you know, people camped and there was singers and like, it was huge. I mean, huge.
So let me stop you for just a second. Where are you from?
I was,
I know that sounds stupid to just interject like that,
that's okay,
but I'm going somewhere with
that. I was born in Cincinnati,
okay,
Ohio, and lived there till I was 5, and then we moved to Detroit, and then we moved to Rome City, Indiana, then we moved to Dearborn, then I moved to Marine City, Michigan, and now I live in Kalamazoo.
Okay, so this, you know, obviously they say they're international. Are they truly international?
Oh, they were. I don't know if they are anymore, but they sure as hell were then.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I don't know the numbers because I haven't really looked into that side of it. I lived it. I knew what it was. Mm-hmm. But absolutely. That festival that they had every summer, it was called the Rock of Ages, was massive. I mean, when I go to like outdoor like festivals, like cherry festivals and things like that, it was like that kind of environment. I mean, there were ice cream tents and huge, you know, tents where we'd have this like revival sermons and stuff. But there was also, you know, an element of like anybody could be welcome. Anybody could be there. There wasn't a lot. It was kind of fun, but also kind of, you know, almost like a concert in some ways.
So do you think Ohio was kind of their North American basis?
Or? Well, when I was in it, the headquarters is in New Knoxville, Ohio, which is this little farming community.
Where's that at?
It's kind of smack dab in the middle of Ohio.
Okay.
And then, but they had campuses all over the world. The campus that, the core campus where I lived for 2 years was in Indiana. They had campuses in Gunnison, Colorado. They had campuses in England. They had, I mean, it was literally all over the world. I mean, I remember one of the people we lived with or were friends with when I was little were from Australia. I mean, it was a very, very big group in the height of the Jesus movement cults is what they're called. So it's funny because I don't say the name of the group a lot in casual conversation, but as soon as I do, I almost always, especially online, someone's like, oh my God, I was in that group for a while, or I know somebody.
Oh, wow.
So it's just one of the less sensationalistic ones because nobody murdered the kids and made them pour Kool-Aid down their throats. it's
way to look at it.
Well, you know, that's exactly what, you know, that's, I do have a dark sense of humor and I deal with things by joking.
Yeah.
But you know, I do, in some ways it could have been worse.
Absolutely.
It could have been a hell of a lot worse.
Absolutely. So at what point did you, you know, at what point did you kind of realize that shit was not right?
Well, to be honest, I'm a real observant person. I'm, you know, whether you want to call it observant or hypervigilant, PTSD, I always kind of notice my surroundings, and I've always been a listener. I was a really well-behaved kid.
Okay.
And so I was always kind of occluded with adults. Like I was just sitting around with the adults. I heard everything all the time. So I listened to all the stuff that was coming out of the leaders' mouths and all the sermons. And then I was listening to the adults, and then I was observing, and I was going out into the world. And so my whole life, I kind of always was like, something feels off about this. Something doesn't feel right. But as I got older, and especially in high school, I started to just feel like, I'm never going to be the kind of person that is going to be accepted in this group. I had a lot of beliefs that they didn't agree with. Subsequently, have found out that my parents, my mom and my stepdad, were getting major pressure from the group because my brother, my stepbrother and I were not taking the classes that they said we should.
Okay.
And there was just a vibe that I was like, this is not good. I don't want to hear sermons about how, and I'm not going to get into all of it, but they were very anti-gay.
Okay.
And when I say anti-gay people, I mean real vitriolic stuff in sermons.
Yeah.
I grew up in theater and singing, and I was around artists, and I loved the people that I was around. They were very much about the woman's place is subservient to the man.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, that's some people's belief system, but I knew that's not who I ever I was going to be. Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty annoying and loud. And so, and I just also that kind of a religious environment for me was not going to work. It was not going to work. So
you talk about being in high school and going through this. Did you go to like a public high school or something like that? Or do they have their own schooling system?
No. You know, I don't know about everyone's experiences. My whole school experience was in public schools.
Okay.
The only time that I was really removed was when we lived on that commune, but we still went to public school.
Okay. So. And you were still able to associate with non-members?
That's one of those things, you know, and I'm sure some of my friends out there who've grown up in groups like this will maybe, you know, relate to this. It is not like I was never told flat out to my face, you are only allowed to associate with members.
Yeah.
But it was always implied. And you also are not given as a child in groups like that, or at least I wasn't, given the opportunity to kind of form those sort of friendships that kids are supposed to have, where you're just joyful and free and fun. Some of that, maybe people had different experiences, but for me, it was one of those things where I was able to make sort of surface friendships when I was growing up, but either I would move and then I wouldn't see those people anymore.
This
is pre-Facebook and pre all those things. Or I knew that there was something weird about or different about the group I grew up in. And at that time, I was not very willing to talk to people about it.
Okay.
I wasn't so much ashamed. It's just, it was something I was trying to get away from and distance myself from. So I didn't want to explain it to people. You know? But recruitment, ministry, outreach was a big part of the group. So we were always pressure was put on us to tell people, bring in new members, things like that, even as kids.
Really?
I have vivid memories of doing ministry outreach in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when I was like a young teenager, where I was asked to walk up to strangers and talk to them. And I'm like, in my little head, I'm like, this shit is not safe. I mean, my parents were like, my mom was there somewhere, but you know, there was just little things as I started getting more mature that I'm like, this is not for me.
That's pretty, for lack of a better word, gnarly.
That's a good word for it. Yeah, it was bullshit is what it was. You know, and I don't, you know, if people ever want to debate with me about what is or what isn't a cult, I mean, I know that there's a lot of groups that do similar things.
Yeah.
Some to different extents, you know, obviously the Mormon Church does a lot of outreach. Jehovah's Witnesses do a lot of outreach. But the thing about it is that, you know, as a kid, I was not thinking, I mean, when you're a kid, you are not thinking about that shit. You shouldn't have to think about that stuff, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
You should be able to focus on, you know, kid stuff.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Riding a skateboard around the house.
Well, yes.
Like you saw earlier.
your sons are awesome and cute.
they're something.
My daughter's a little older, so no skateboarding for her right now.
Yeah, my kids were skateboarding in the house. So they're heathens for sure.
I liked them. They're awesome.
Good kids. They're good kids, but they're heathens. And what you haven't heard yet, and what the listeners have heard by now, is last week they were on the show. So it was a fun episode.
Aw, I can't wait to listen to
them. Yeah, it was a fun episode.
And I also got to meet your awesome dog.
Yeah, my dog is, she's something else too. She actually is, she likes to play with the MBI dogs, which are Ruger and Titus, which are Bob's dogs.
I didn't get to meet them last time.
Well, they're monsters too. So.
Aren't they big German shepherds?
They are
or something?
Huge German shepherds.
Your little Ambrosia dog is much less intimidating than a German
shepherd. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. She is a quarter of the size of those dogs.
Although I will say, I think Pete, my dog, who is a whole 11 pounds and has epilepsy and takes so many meds that it costs hundreds of dollars a month, could probably intimidate all of them.
That's funny. So, not to get back on topic, get back on topic here. So, growing up, you know, you obviously say they're very controlling, very coercive. Was it one of those like corporal punishment type things or?
Well, and you know, as a kid, this is what I can tell you. Like I said, I was a really good kid.
Okay.
I think some of that is stuff I learned before when I was real little to be safety. You know, it's something that when you grow up in certain environments where there is violence, unfortunately, your instincts get formed early. And I think, you know, I would sit back and I would be quiet. And so I didn't have a lot of that happen to me.
Okay.
I was, to be frank, you know, kind of sarcastically, I was the little star. I used to sing for the group. I was on stage. You know, I was kind of pushed in some ways, and in some ways I enjoyed it, to be sort of an example of how a kid should act.
Okay.
But what I would see, because of, you know, that look in and always having my nose in a book, sitting outside while the other kids are playing, was now as an adult, I realize kids acting completely normal, doing completely normal things, getting whooped with wooden spoons.
Yeah.
And sometimes not by their parents, because you got to remember that was a big, big, big thing, especially when we lived on that communal living environment for 2 years. Always people who aren't your parents are taking care of you.
Yeah.
Always. Not, I mean, my mom was there, but you know, they work you hard. So there were times where she was working in the group, and a lot of, you know, sort of like village parenting. So, you know, you're running around whooping people on the butt with a wooden spoon just for acting like a normal kid because the group is so rigid about certain things.
I've heard that in multiple other cults too, is basically, I don't want to say in the guidelines, but in the guidelines, they say that any adult is able to discipline any child.
Mm-hmm. That was absolutely something that, especially because, you know, those 2 years, what it was called was the family core. That's what my mom was in. And family, because obviously she had kids. They had core programs that were people that did not have children. But so everyone in the group had, you know, children. And yeah, absolutely. There were always people disciplining other people's kids. Some people who you could tell didn't want to be dealing with the kids. Some people who were wonderful and loving. Yeah. I mean, I had, you know, some second mothers at times too. So it's just when you put a mix of people together, a big group of people, and you inject children into it and you inject all this rigidness, bad shit can happen, you know. And I don't talk a lot with other people who have been through this group. Probably maybe I should do that a little bit more now that the internet exists. But, you know, when there's that kind of rigidity, when you're raising a child, they were big, spare the rod, spoil the child kind of things. And that's something that, you know, is a whole nother topic. But I can tell you from my understanding, not only as a parent, but also as a, you know, trauma-informed psychologist who works with kids and teenagers who are high-risk teenagers, that's something that that sticks with a kid and can do more damage than you realize sometimes. Even, you know, the sting goes away on your ass, but you know, the way it made you feel, the fear, is sometimes something that doesn't go away for a long time.
So. No, I can imagine that. And that's a big part of it. And that's basically PTSD.
It can be PTSD inducing for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, like the reason I'm going to name the podcast Relatively Unscathed is because, you know, I mean, There's a thing, you know, and we're going to talk more on the podcast about complex PTSD versus, you know, quote unquote regular PTSD. But when you've had a lot of experiences, and it doesn't have to be in a cult, it can be in any household, no matter what income, no matter what socioeconomic status, color, race, religion, whatever, where the underlying thing is, rigidity, punishment, overly disciplinarianness, you know, and of course, then if you add in violence, like actual physical violence, that kind of sustained terror or sustained walking on eggshells feeling can create PTSD symptoms that you have to deal with your whole life, just like any other chronic illness, because PTSD is a chronic neurological illness.
Yeah.
So
100%.
Yeah, for sure.
So you mentioned the term family core earlier. What is a family core? So obviously it's more than just your family.
Yes. Well, this group that I was in was very hierarchical. So they based their structure on a tree.
Okay.
So, and they used a lot of metaphors, farming metaphors, growing metaphors, and I'm a big plant nerd, so I liked that part. But you, in order to kind of move up the hierarchy, you had to do what they said. And one of the things was you started off as like twigs, is the groups that you went to. There was branches, there was limbs, there was trunk coordinators, and all this hierarchy. Well, in order to kind of move up, you had to be willing to take all the classes and then go on these mission trips. And then the core was when almost like their college experience.
Okay.
And at first I believe, and I'd have to think and ask my mom, at first they didn't allow people who had children in that core. It was almost like at the very beginning of the group. But then as the group got bigger and bigger and bigger, my mom was a core member.
Okay.
But part of that was you had to go and live on one of the campuses for 2 years. So the only place that had a family core, as far as I remember, was Indiana and maybe Colorado. I don't remember, honestly. Okay. I was so little. So, and what it was basically we lived there for 2 years. We grew our own food. We slaughtered chickens. They raised everything. We had some contact with the Amish community for like exchanging things. But there were hundreds of people, a lot of people that lived there. And so you had everything from doctors, lawyers, bums, teachers, all their kids. And it was just sort of like a commune environment. Yeah. And then once we left those 2 years, because we'd gone through those 2 years, my mom was sort of higher up on the leadership thing and was sent out to another place to start a twig and to start a new group. And yeah, that's kind of how it goes.
Okay.
Like so, branching out.
So these classes that you were supposed to take, did you take any of the classes?
Oh, yeah.
So what was entailed in these classes?
Oh, shit. Hold on a second.
No, you're good.
It depends on which one you're talking about. They had a lot of classes. So the first class was called Power for Abundant Living. And Dr. Victor Paul Werewolf made the class. And that was the original leader. And so it was the fundamentals of his version of Christianity. Okay. Basically, that's the quick way to do it. Okay. But the class was long, like several hours sitting in a room, videotaping this old guy on a screen. It was not fun. And I did not want to be doing it at the age I did it at. And then there was an intermediate class. They had a Christian family and sex class that I had to take when I started puberty. And that fucking sucked ass. Sitting in that class with a bunch of it was weird.
Yeah.
Because it was adults and kids in the class, and it was supposed to be about, sex. It was basically like sex ed, but their version of it, and it was just fucking weird.
Oh my goodness. It sounds weird.
There's an advanced class, which I never took, and that's why my parents got so much shit when I was in high school, because me and my stepbrother were clearly not too into it.
Yeah.
I think I'd have to ask my stepsister. I'm pretty sure, because my stepsister and my brother are 2 years younger than me.
Okay.
And so I'm pretty sure she actually took the advanced class. And it was just like each class kind of talked more about stuff that they're proselytized about.
Okay.
Their views on everything. And yeah, so.
So, and it was kind of based in Christianity?
It is a form of, yes. And this is where like I said, the guy who started it, the first guy, was a Baptist evangelical minister and then started the group. And then when he died, the guy who took over was also originally a Christian dude. And it was absolutely a form of Christianity. They had some beliefs about their interpretation of the Bible that are very, if I understand it, blasphemous to standard Christians. Like they didn't exactly believe in the Father, Son, Holy Ghost being equal, all that stuff.
Okay.
Honestly, I think I blanked some of this stuff out. I probably could have told you better. I think I used to definitely drift off during a lot of the sermons.
Yeah.
If you go online, like I'm telling you, if anybody has interest in this specific group, just type in the Way International. There's books survivors have written. There's tons of like Wikipedia pages. And the Wikipedia page is pretty comprehensive and it's honestly pretty well written. I mean, it covers the details like that. For me, it was, when I was in the group, I could give you chapter and verse. Because like I said, I was a real observant kid. And I'm a pretty smart woman. And I've always been a pretty smart kid. They wanted to, skip me in grades, but the group wouldn't allow it. Things like that. But that's what I mean is like, I knew chapter and verse. There are versions of everything. But that's the thing is, even as I was reading it, and looking at things and having my little Bible that I was told to write notes in things. I was like, I don't know if I believe this. And it wasn't so much, I have my own religious or not so much religious spiritual beliefs now, but it was just for me a weird situation where I didn't feel like this was ever going to work for me.
Yeah.
And as the group progressed, like I told you when before we were on off air, the group still exists, but they had a major lawsuit and like around the year 2000, the current leader got hella in trouble for sexual shit and got financially sued and stuff too.
Which, that's a pretty standard thing in cults, it seems like.
Weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's very common. So,
you said that was around 2000, you said?
Yeah, and I graduated from high school in 1996. Okay. So in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, I'm like, I'm not going to do this. I don't want to do this. And it caused major problems in my household.
Yeah.
And when I say major problems, I mean, I don't know if my parents would say this, but I was essentially kicked out of my house some ways. I mean, I graduated from high school. I stayed in my house, and I don't think they see it this way, but there were several times where when I started standing up for myself a little bit more and saying, you know, I'm not doing this the way you're talking to me, you know, the way this is going is not okay, was more vocal about it.
Yeah.
Because the group was so hierarchical, our family was also very hierarchical. My stepdad didn't always like that.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of a my way or the highway situation. So, you know, when I left to go to college, I wasn't on my own, as in I never talked to my family, but I was financially on my own. I knew that I didn't have a whole lot of emotional support about things. It was sort of a, you know, I got to make my own way if I'm going to figure this out. So,
yeah. Do you think that in your experience within your family, you know, you talk about discipline and that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you think it was to the point of physical abuse or mental abuse? I mean, did you feel that and that was part of wanting to get out of it? Or was it just understanding that what was going on wasn't right?
I would never say in my, because, you know, you have to talk about which family, like my first family, of course, my dad, but then my family before my mom got remarried, and then my family when she got remarried, because it was a yours, mine, and ours kind of situation, because it was also a, you know, basically a blended family. There was definitely some emotional and mental abuse.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of hard to say because my stepdad is still alive and, you know, there's a lot of hurt and pain that I think I've dealt with a lot and I've worked a lot really hard to, but I think that, you know, they are still dealing with. And there was no physical abuse by my immediate family. I did have some abuse by other people.
Okay.
When I was younger.
Within the group?
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, there was some incidents that happened, and, you know, they all happened when my mom wasn't around. And she wasn't around because she was a neglectful mom.
Yeah.
She wasn't around because, I mean, she was working and she was doing things, you know, anything. That's one of the things that these groups sometimes, and when I say these groups, I mean any kind of group where adults have access to children and are asked to care for children, and especially when you don't always know the adults, these kind of groups foster a almost overnight familiarity.
Okay.
Where, you know, there's a brotherhood, there's a sisterhood, there's this bond. And so sometimes your kids end up getting taken care of by people that either aren't safe because they don't have kids, so they don't know what the hell they're doing, or, you know, there's people who are attracted to these groups for shitty, abusive, horrible reasons.
Yeah.
And yeah, I did have some abuse happen before. I think, you know, any kind of group that is really rigid and really structured and really puts pressure on people can foster abusive environments. And when you're a child growing up in a group like this, you don't have... Any child doesn't have any choice about the way they're growing up. And when you layer on top of it, you don't have choice about the way you grow up. And you're being told this is the way to live and these people are this. And it's just, it's confusing. It's really confusing for a kid. And, you know, in retrospect, I've had PTSD symptoms my whole life.
Okay.
But I was a very functional child. I mean, from the outside, nobody would have known. And part of that was what I was socialized in the group as. The role that I was in the group was just this little kid who, you know, pretty little girl who blonde hair, sings, gets good grades.
Yeah, you were essentially the golden child.
I was. And, you know, it's funny because I didn't feel like it.
Yeah.
But, you know, in retrospect, especially among my siblings, I know like some of my siblings felt like I got treated differently. But then as I got older, and this is how one of the reasons, you know, a group is starting to become problematic. When people's viewpoints change and they start to exert their own free will, if the group comes down on you like a ton of bricks and the structure starts crumbling into you, you know that there might be something to think about there, because that's part of development at that age. You're supposed to spread your wings. You're supposed to try out new things. And when that's just crushed down, whether it's a church or a, you know, any kind of group, really, mm-hmm. that's a problem. That's, in my opinion, too much influence.
No, I agree. So. I wholeheartedly agree that that's a problem. Yeah. And like you said, you know, free will is an important part of growing up.
Yeah.
Some people get more free will than others, mm-hmm. but if it's, you know, basically, like you said, totally taken away from you, mm-hmm. or they're trying to take it away from you, that's mm-hmm. extremely dangerous.
It is. It's that undue influence, and there's a continuum of it. And if you look up some other, you know, some of the cult researchers, they talk about it a lot. There's normal developmental stages children go through. And the thing is when the ethos or the environment of the group and the structure of the group and the leader's opinions and their dictates are more important than allowing a child to develop normally, or even allowing adults to behave normally.
Yeah.
And when I say normally, I mean that there's a range of behavior, that there's a range of a thought, that there's a range of opinions. That's problematic.
Yeah.
That should always be a red flag to people, no matter what the group's about.
Well, and there's definitely different maturity levels. So you said your mom had you young and she was 20.
Yep.
So she was in that cult about that age, right? Mm-hmm. Now 20 is an adult, mm-hmm. but the maturity of a 20-year-old, for the most part, they're not very mature. Mm-hmm. Now there's a huge spectrum of maturity. You can have very mature 20-year-olds,
yeah.
but for the most part, they're not. Mm-mm. So I could definitely see that, you know, not only are they opposing the free will of children, but now they're opposing free will of people like your mother, who mm-hmm. is technically adult, but is needing that guidance and leadership that they're just not getting.
Yeah. And, you know, it's that delicate balance. And I think there's two things. One is that, yeah, she was an adult. And my mother and my, you know, many people who join groups like this are doing the best that they can.
Yeah.
They, you know, are either from bad situations or they're not, or they're, you know, whatever. They're trying the best they can. She thought this was, you know, she thought it was what it was. And it's hard because, you know, all that testing I did with teens and all that, your executive functioning, which is, you know, part of neurology, look it up on, give it a goog. And it's basically not developed until you're in your 20s.
Yeah.
Longer for men. You know, that's not something I'm making up. It's something that it develops later in men than women. And that's your decision making, your processing, your metacognition, all that fancy schmancy words. But it's basically, you don't make freaking good decisions when you're young.
Absolutely.
Your brain is still developing.
Absolutely.
And,
you know, Rogan, I don't know how much you're a stand up comedian, into stand up comedy you are. But,
No, but I know who Joe Rogan
but
is.
Rogan has a bit on his newest stand up about 17-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And he's like, they're just learning how to talk, you know?
It's hilarious because before when I used to do assessments, you know, you do all this testing, you interview the parents, you interview the kids, you write these long ass reports where you explain not only the results of the testing, the kids' IQ, the blah, 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 the diagnosis, but you also have to talk to them about treatment planning. And, you know, I feel very strongly because I've done a lot of work with teenagers that teenagers need, they're smart, even though they're not always smart, they deserve to know what's going on. And so I would always also explain it to them. I do use a lot of comedy. I use a lot of swearing. I use a lot of, well, frankly, it's just my personality when I talk to people. And you're right. Your brain is not done developing. It doesn't mean you're not responsible for your choices. We all have to be responsible for our choices, but it is something to take into account that, you know, when my mom was trying to make good choices for her children, which none of us were planned, you know, and so she got pregnant with me, and she says, you know, it makes me cry sometimes, she says getting pregnant with me saved her life because it gave her motivation to realize that, and she knew my dad was going to hurt her, or that he was going to kill her, basically.
Yeah.
He was a horrible alcoholic, and he would get drunk, and he would beat the living hell out of her. And one night he held her at gunpoint, and, the neck, you know, she left. And left, you know, he was a very, very, very violent man. And you know, I have memories of horrible things, but that doesn't mean that they're all that, like, I've done a lot of work to deal with the things and be able to talk about them without it triggering PTSD symptoms.
Yeah.
There are certain things that I just get triggered about and I have bad days, but I think I got off topic. But anyways, I think my mom was searching for safety, was searching for family, was searching for stability, and she found it somewhere. And for her, for many years, it was that way. And it also was for us at times, but these groups do take advantage of the fact of that people who are needy are more vulnerable to it. So.
Yeah.
Anyways, I got off topic.
No, that's the beauty of this, is there is no off topic. We're allowed to run into the weeds.
Yeah, I like it. So,
so you know, at the moment you're leaving, mm-hmm. I know it's probably not a defined moment of like, this is when I left, but you said mm-hmm. you're 17, 18 years old?
Yep. And I mean, I started dating.
Okay.
I started, you know, we moved between middle school and high school. Middle school was bad years for me. Yeah. And there was just a lot of reasons, not just with the group, just, you know, those are hard years. Middle school freaking sucks. Yeah. I mean, if you got a good middle school experience, good for you. But so we moved several hours away, or like, I think it was 2 hours or 1 hour north of where we were living. We lived in Dearborn. We moved north to a tiny town, small town on the St. Clair River.
Okay.
And my high school experience overall, despite being in this group and despite struggling with things that, you know, those kind of things, was not horrific.
Okay.
You know, my mom had remarried. She'd married my stepdad. He had a good job. He was, you know, things like that. So there was no financial craziness other than the pressure the group put on them, which made them tense all the time. But I loved school, made friends, tried to work hard to actually keep those friendships, because I knew we were going to live there for the 4 years, or I thought we were, and we did end up living there. You know, started doing all the normal teenage things, did, you know, musical theater in school, you know, all the fun stuff. But as things progressively got worse at home, and when I say worse, I just meant that the group started to get more and more and more invasive in people's lives.
Okay.
And it was just a tense, yucky environment. I always knew that education was going to be my way out of things in life. I always knew that.
Yeah.
And I got a scholarship to Western. So I got an academic scholarship. So I was like, heck yeah, I'm out of here. And then that year leading up, my senior year leading up to leaving to go to Western was not great, good and bad, but not the greatest.
Yeah.
And then my first 2 years of college, every time I would go home for the summer, I got kicked out both times.
Oh, jeez.
And it was just not, I mean, one summer we lived at home, but there was so much tension and so much arguing and so much shit. And then the next summer, I don't even remember, I got in a fight with my stepdad, and it was basically like, I'm getting the hell out of here. And I did have, you know, I had friends, and I had my boyfriend, and, you know, at that time, my boyfriend. I had some safe havens that I had created for myself and that I had found. But, you know, it's a little hard when you, it's a little hard, that's minimizing, when you have a family, but you don't feel accepted by them for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing, you know, trying to foster unconditional love for your children. And that's that influence that these groups have when it gets in the way of you being able to parent the way you want to parent. Or it's just, it got to be so much. And I knew that I didn't ever want to be somebody who was their definition of what a good woman was.
Yeah.
That wasn't me. I was too loud. I was too everything to them.
Well, and it sounds like that, you know, they wanted women to be second-class citizens.
And it, you know, it's crazy because the group also, like, my mom was not quiet. You know, my mom, she's kind of submissive, but I think what it was, it's this clusterfuck of, sorry, I use that word too much. It is this messed up version of, like, what you're preached to is that men and women, the man's the head of the household, the woman is his helper.
Yeah.
Helpmeet, I think, is the word they use a lot. And that, of course, then the way they temper that is to say, if, you know, if it works right, then one is the king and queen, and, you know, whatever. If those are your religious beliefs, all I know is in practicality, my mom ran her house because she was, after she got married, she was a stay-at-home mom. And my stepdad worked because he had to pay for all five of us kids and tithing, and they had to do all this religious stuff. And I got off track again, but it's just, it's one of those things where I knew that I was never going to, that's not what I wanted. That's not the life I wanted. Religion being the sole focus of our life was not what I wanted. I wanted other things to be the focus of my life. So
that makes sense. So with most groups like this, and I don't know this group in particular, but when you decided to leave, did the group really pressure your mom to disassociate with you?
You know, I haven't used that word with my mom, but what I can say is that during that time, so I guess that would be from like about 1994 to 2000, I would say. The first dude that ran the group died, and I remember when I was younger, but the second group, the guy that took over, was a narcissistic asshole, amongst other things, like a flaming homophobe and just the most dumbass freaking, I don't have good feelings about it. Sorry, Reverend Martindale, if you're still alive and listening. But he was, now as a freaking psychologist, I sometimes want to write a profile of the dude, but he's still alive and I'll try to be respectful. And who knows, maybe he's reformed, whatever. their influence in our family's life was so profound. Now as an adult, I've talked to my parents about it, but then I didn't know.
Yeah.
Like I said, my stepbrother and I were both pretty good kids in high school. You know, they got tons of pressure that we weren't taking the right classes. And actually, I found out recently they were the leadership of the group, like some of the, not the highest up leaders, because we didn't live near them. We were in Michigan by then. We're going to confront us, teenagers, sit us down and talk to us. Basically, they use the word reprove. reprove us. Yes, that was their fancy word for tell you what you're doing is wrong.
I need to look that word up. Yes. I've never heard that word before.
They reprove. Had lots of, that's another thing. Groups like this, they all have buzzwords. And yeah. I can still, there's ones like they had, there's sayings, you know, phrases, propaganda, if you want to use the word. To kind of, it's one of those brain, you wouldn't want to use the word brainwashing. They're techniques. They're not things that people, these group leaders study. Some of them come by it naturally. Some of them develop the things, but yeah. So they were going to sit us down and reprove me and my stepbrother because we weren't doing these groups, and my mom and my stepdad wouldn't let them. And that caused a major rift in my mom and stepdad's relationship with the group because they kind of started standing up for us.
Yeah.
And I think it's because at that time they were also starting to notice some of the suddenly this didn't feel like a family anymore. The bigger group didn't, it felt like I don't know. I don't want to use inflammatory words, but it just felt like not a family and not a loving environment.
A governing body
with the whip hand.
Yeah.
You know, not literally always, but where, you know, you're not a good man if you can't get your kids to do what you want. You know, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, whatever. I don't know. I know that a lot of churches and a lot of groups are structured that way. And I'm not saying having leadership isn't a good thing in life.
Yeah.
But leaders that are out for their own needs more than, you know, the people that they lead causes problems. Nothing we're going to talk about politically. Yeah.
So did your siblings follow suit with you?
Yeah. And it's funny because I think we kind of joke around, and I don't have a super duper close relationship with all my siblings, but we all are, you know, sort of close. There's actually five of us. It's me and my stepbrother are the same age. So, and then my real biological brother and my stepsister are the same age, and we're 2 years apart. So it was basically like having two sets of twins when my mom and my stepdad got married. And then they have a child who is 11 years younger than me. So she's 30. So, I forgot that. What the hell? Where was I going with this?
If your siblings followed suit.
Oh, yeah. So, me and my stepbrother, it was very clear we weren't interested. And as soon as we both went to college, it was pretty much a no-go for him and I. And then my biological brother, he is an outdoorsman. He never liked to sit still. He never really, I don't think he bought into it, but he's also not a big... He wanted to be out in the woods. He wanted to be hunting. He wanted to be fishing. And so when he had to sit in these sermons for hours memorizing Bible verses, and then if he didn't memorize them right, it was really a challenge for him. And so I don't think he was ever fully in, but he also, you know, I think it took him a little bit longer. We all kind of left home as soon as we were, I mean, we didn't, but we did. None of us lived at home after a certain age. So we were kind of on our own. We were around our parents, but I know my stepsister took a few more classes than I did, I think, because she was at the home 2 more years than I was when I went to college. And then my little sister, the baby sister who's 30 and who's having her tonsils out today. Hey, Katie, if you listen to this, hope you get better soon. I don't know, because she was 5 when I left home. And I don't know if she took any of the classes, because in 2000, she was born in 1989, so she was little. So I don't think... I don't know if she took any of them.
Okay.
I don't know. So, anywho. And we all kind of, none of us participate in the group at all anymore. My parents, my mom and my stepdad, when that big sex scandal happened, they left too.
Okay. So they hung around for a little bit longer.
They did. But they were fading away.
Okay.
Basically, from the time that we graduated, so 1996 to 2000, they were slowly fading. You know, a little bit here and there. But because my mom was disillusioned, she told me, she was like, this isn't what I signed up for, basically. This is not what I signed up for. And then, you know, they kind of go down, down, down. And then this big sex scandal happened with Mr. Martindale. And my mom's kind of, I mean, her foundation was rocked to the core, and she's still to this day, her faith was rocked.
Yeah.
Because for her, you know, this was more than just a club she joined. This wasn't a club, you know.
Yeah.
Her faith and her religious beliefs and her beliefs in God and things were fundamental to how she lived her life. And it was her whole life, her whole adult life. For me, it was like, okay, I'm leaving a shitty environment, or I'm leaving this group that I don't know what I want to be in. But you're supposed to leave home at that age.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, most people do.
Yeah.
Except for nowadays. You know, but when she had to leave the group or chose to stop associating with the group, it was a huge deal for her. And she struggled. She did, you know, I don't know if she would want me to say this, but, you know, she developed some depression, some addiction issues for a little while. And she's, you know, thankfully not dealing with that anymore. But, you know, she struggled really, really hard, and she's still healing from it.
Yeah.
She's still healing from it. And I think she always will, because, yeah, you know, her finding out, and as an adult, me being able to talk to her in more depth about things I went through when I was young, when she wasn't there, or her seeing some of the destruction it did to our family as a unit.
Well, and at this point, you know, if the sex scandal happened 2000-ish, you know, she's at this point been in 20 plus years in this group.
Yep, exactly.
That's, you know, that is your everything.
Yep. And I mean, I almost I don't know how to make an analogy of it, but like, think about, you know, my mom wasn't a nun by any chance, but like, if that's your whole life, your whole, it was essentially her vocation. My mom worked, don't get me wrong. She worked her ass off, you know, doing anything she could, hustling to, you know, she started a home cleaning business, you know, waiting tables, doing anything. But, you know, when this is your vocation and the thing you make your life center around and it gets rocked to the core, you know, that's something that it takes time and work and therapy, if that's your thing.
Yeah.
And for her, you know, also the spiritual healing that had to happen, because that's something that's so important to her, deciding whether she wants to go to another church, whether she wants to go back to the Way International. That's something that she's thought about. So
when you find out everything you know is basically wrong, it's earth-shattering.
Yeah. Well, and the worst thing for her, at least what she's told me, is that it was almost like, she still has some of the religious beliefs.
Yeah.
Because they, like I said, it's based on Christianity. So she still has some of those faith-based beliefs, Bible-based beliefs. You know, they were very much into the Bible is the word of God, the spoken word of God, or whatever, written word of God. I can't remember. But so to have the leadership, who are people, fuck everybody over, literally and figuratively, and break that foundation, well, she's still, like, she was floundering for a while. And, you know, she's working on things. She goes to therapy and she talks to us and she's working on it. And that's all anybody can ask. I've also had to work on some major things. I've by no means been perfect or had a perfect life since I left the group. So
how long did it take you once you left the group to kind of cope with what you'd been through?
I'm still coping with
it. Yeah, I guess that was a bad term to use.
But, no, I'm just kidding.
But I know the little bit I know about you, I know that it's been some time before you've been comfortable talking about it.
I used to jokingly bring it up. Like when I would go to a new job and people would ask about my childhood, I'd be like, oh, I grew up on a commune, or I was in a cult, you know, and people would joke. And then if they were genuinely interested, I'd talk to them. But as far as talking about it publicly, like on a podcast, things like that, no, it's only been probably the last year. And weirdly enough, I'm going to tell you right now, one of the most cathartic, I don't know, and I know you don't listen to true crime, but True Crime Obsessed did an episode on Jonestown that was so cathartic for me to listen to, even though it's a kind of a comedy joking podcast.
Yeah.
And I told them thank you when I was at Crime Con, because for me to hear their outside perspective and for them to get it and be able to articulate it in a way that I'd been trying to articulate it to people, but they just didn't understand. And, you know, how, you know, lucky I was in some ways to not have been in a group like that, or like Waco and things like that. It is, you know, I don't know if you want to use the word blessing, but like, I have, you know, struggled and still struggle, not just with the things about growing up in that group and the things that happened, but, you know, honestly, things before my mom joined, you know, like I said, my brain was formed in trauma. And that's not something I'm ashamed of. It's something that my life went through. And it's something that millions of people, if you grow up in an environment where there's domestic violence, it has a profound impact on children, a profound impact on their neurological development. It's not a irreparable impact. It is something, though, that takes work. It takes adjustment, the way any chronic illness does.
Yeah.
So, and because, of course, I have the training, I am able to implement the tools for myself, but I'm by no means perfect. I've screwed up and I've had periods of time where I did not handle things well.
We all go through that though, for sure.
Yeah. I had some, you know, brief stint in rehab for a few years, not for a few years. I was only in rehab for a few weeks, but there were periods of time where my symptoms got bad. And I also have another neurological condition that complicates things. I have narcolepsy.
Okay.
So when you have two kind of fighting neurological conditions, sometimes you just don't know which end is up. Like, I don't know if I have a day where I can't wake up fully. I don't know if it's because I'm triggered by something.
Yeah.
If I have a bad episode of narcolepsy and I kind of do a what's called fall, it's cataplexy, where you kind of lose muscle tone. Okay. And you fall to the ground. You don't fall asleep. You just fall to the ground. I don't know if that's because something just startled me and I'm PTSD and out or what. So yeah. That's why I rely on the specialist.
When did you find out you had narcolepsy?
When I was 30 years old.
30 years old.
Yes.
Did you have symptoms before that?
I realize now I did. Yeah. I just thought I was weird. And because I didn't talk to a lot of people in depth, because that's not something the group encouraged.
Yeah.
I just didn't know that all these symptoms were what it was. And it took me until, and that's not uncommon. It takes about a decade of symptoms sometimes to get that diagnosis. But
wow,
yeah.
I didn't realize that.
It's a really misunderstood disorder, and, you know, give it a Google.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's got some weird ass symptoms, and it exists on a continuum. It's not like the jokey movies where everybody, some people do fall face first, but yeah, fall asleep when they're driving. But I'm very, very lucky. I have a little bit milder version.
So. Okay.
It still is a pain in the ass to deal with. So when I've been asleep, like, for 2 days, when I have a, like, it's almost, I'm like a bear. I hibernate, and I just, not in winter always. Like, yeah, if I get a flare up, sometimes I'll be asleep for a whole, like, 16 hours, and, or I'll, it's a complicated disorder, and we could probably, we'll talk about it on Relatively Unscathed, maybe get somebody on who has a more severe form to talk about how, okay, it's impacted their life. But it definitely has had an impact on my life. It's had an impact on my decision to work from home, because, okay, you know, being my own boss and things, setting my own hours, it's something that's not only enjoyable and something I want to do, but something that I think will be valuable for my health. And putting my health first, when you have chronic health conditions, whether they're mental health conditions, physical health conditions, invisible conditions,
yeah,
you kind of have to.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
If you don't, you get kicked in the ass.
So as I'm sure you're aware of now, I just went through a bunch of physical issues. Mm-hmm. I was on a health hiatus, I'll call it. And that was exactly it, is I could have came back sooner to do this. I could have came back sooner to do a lot of things. But at a certain point, I knew that I needed to get healthy, like 100% healthy. I am a pedal to the floor, balls to the wall. I go until I can't go anymore. I am that person. I've always been that person. And it leads me down some bad roads sometimes. And this time, it happened to be my health. I had worn myself out so bad, and I needed the break to get healthy.
Yeah.
I almost died.
What happened?
So to recap, I got sick. I had pneumonia.
Yeah.
Well, I had influenza A, which is the bad one.
Yeah.
I never did anything to help that. I just continued going 900 miles an hour. I ended up with double pneumonia. Again, just kept fighting. Mm-hmm. Got to the point that I couldn't breathe. I was admitted to the hospital. My wife took me to the emergency room. I ended up in the hospital for the better part of a week. It really shook me knowing, you know, those nurses basically told me they weren't sure I was going to walk out of there.
Jesus.
Because I was that far gone. Like, it wasn't that I had this double pneumonia. It was that it was that far advanced that they weren't sure that
you were going to make it.
That I was going to make it.
That's terrifying.
And basically, what it came down to is I am a healthy 34-year-old man that stays healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And had it not been for that, I would have died.
Yeah.
That simple.
Yeah.
So I completely get what you're saying about understanding that you need to put, sometimes you need to stop and put things first.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard for me to do because I've never done that in my life. Mm-hmm. I've always been this person that, like, I have 90 projects going and I will figure out how to do it. I joke all the time that I wish the day had 8 more hours in it so, mm-hmm, I could figure out how to do more. Like, yeah, I've always been that person. I hate sitting still. I literally this weekend took 2 days off in a row. I've not had 2 days off in a row and I couldn't tell you how long. And by the end of the first day, I was like, I might need to go to work. I'm just not that person.
Yeah.
So it's taken a lot. It's taken this for me to understand that, like, sometimes you have to reset yourself.
Oh, absolutely. And it's like, I know it sounds cliche and new agey, but like putting yourself first, and that, you know, when you're an adult and you have responsibilities, job, family, all that stuff, sometimes it feels like you can't. And my experience in life, when you can't, you know, obviously you still got to go to work, you still got to make money. It just becomes a thing where your body will make you stop.
Yeah.
It will make you. And my body literally makes me stop. I fall asleep sometimes. But like, I mean, you know, listening to our bodies and giving our bodies what they need and caring for them. You know, I've been on a little bit of a health kick, partly stress induced, but, you know, partly, you know, because I want my body to be as strong as my mind.
Yeah.
And because, you know, your body can give out on you. You know, I've had, unfortunately, lost my father-in-law to esophageal cancer. And, you know, my grandmother died last year. You know, we only got one life. And, you know, as much as we can, we have to do what's best for our health. And everybody's health conditions are different. And having accommodations and understanding for those things is something that I think we can do better at as a society. And just talking to people about what they're going through, because I have health issues and I joke about them, but the hard shit about them, I don't talk to a lot of people about them. You know, when I'm having a day where I'm like, fuck this, I can't go to my daughter's things because I can't stay awake.
Yeah.
Or when I can't go to something because I can't drive myself because I know it wouldn't be super safe. I also have chosen to do some alternative treatments that are legal in Michigan for PTSD and legal recreationally now, that have affected my ability to actually work for agencies. Because if I'm upfront with people, because
yeah.
I disclose that I have, you know, a disability and chronic illness on my application. And I tell people when, if they want to hire me and I get the sense, I'm like, look, if we do a drug test, I'm going to come up positive for cannabis. I use it to treat PTSD. And I think it's a very you know, valuable treatment for PTSD. And it's only something that I've done for like the last 2 years. Yeah. So,
which I fully agree with.
Yeah.
Well.
And I mean, and you know, we'll, you know, we can talk about this here or wherever, but I believe that, yeah, I think that, you know, it's a medication that if used, especially if used by an educated therapist or under the supervision of an educated, you know, health provider, can really be beneficial for people.
Yeah.
Not to mention all the benefits it can have for cancer, pain, migraines. Honestly, it's done more to help my health than the countless prescriptions I've been on.
Yeah.
And it's become something I use. But anyways, we went off topic. I forgot what we were talking about.
So let's talk about your podcast for a little bit.
Okay.
So relatively unscathed.
Yep.
I think it's a great idea.
Thank you.
Do you have a release date?
I do not. I'm hoping in the next week or two.
That would be awesome.
If anybody, including Zach, gave me a little bit of a primer, but I just don't know how to do all the audio shit. I know how to interview people. I got a microphone. I got a computer. I got a logo. But, you know, I think some of Zach's offered to help me a little bit. And, you know, I definitely want to jump in, but I'm one of those people who definitely does my research first. I also have, you know, I want it to be done with thought and intent.
Yeah.
It's not for me something I'm doing for fun necessarily, although it is fun to do these.
Oh, absolutely.
It's something that I want to do to help educate people, to help, you know, my little tagline I'm trying to come up with or write, you know, at the beginning that you're supposed to introduce yourself is that, you know, we all go through shit, like trials, tribulations, the things life throw at us. But I think by hearing other people's sometimes worst experiences, the things that they survived, not only can we learn about what happened to them, but you can really learn from how people have developed resilience and tenacity and courage. Because when you're victimized, when you're not in control, when you're a victim of something, it does, in my opinion, take work to develop a survivor mentality. You know, we lose so many people to suicide in this country.
Yep.
And pain and unresolved trauma. And there's so many of my friends and my coworkers who are working their asses off, you know, every day, teachers, to try to help kids that are struggling. And I feel like if we become more informed about that as a society, it can improve our policing. It can improve everything. That's my hope, is that we'll be able to talk to people and have survivors come on and tell their own stories, and then always educate and hopefully leave people with a little bit of hope, a little bit of, you know, inspiration, a little bit of fire under their butt that, You know, if they have to walk through hell, they can walk with their head held high and not be ashamed of the things that have done that were done to them or that they went through that were out of their control. Take responsibility for not letting the shit that you went through as a kid go another generation of trauma. Yes. And you know, things like that. So I'm hoping that it will be something that people can enjoy and we can have some fun too.
Yeah, so. I absolutely love the idea.
Thank you.
And I'm happy that you brought it to my attention, and I'm going to be really happy to help you as much as I can. Because I do think it's an important thing. That's kind of, you know, we've talked about this, but that's my idea with this podcast in particular. Mm-hmm. It's to get out there and help people. And I think that's extremely important.
Yeah, and Bob agreed to be on, and I don't know, you're his friend, but I'm going to try to make him cry and talk about his childhood.
So. Bob will cry.
Oh, he cried.
Bob will cry.
Yeah, he got a little teared up when we were on the Truth and Justice Friday follow-up.
No,
so.
Bob, if you listen to the episode, episode 10 of Made Us, Bob cries in there.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, I've probably cried in multiple episodes of Made Us. Yeah. Like,
I think that's a good thing. We should all cry more. We should all yell more, swear more. I like talking to people in bars. I like talking to people in restaurants and people I meet on the street and just having real conversations with people where you're not afraid to let your guard down. And so it's something that I've always enjoyed doing. And it's part of the reason why I became a psychologist was I usually can build rapport with people pretty fast. Usually. Not always.
That's awesome. So the way I end every episode is I ask for a piece of advice.
Okay.
So if you had one piece of advice or a set of advice for people, you know, whether it is trying to leave a group, maybe not necessarily a cult, maybe it's a relationship, maybe, you know, it could be a cult, anything. What would that piece of advice be?
Whether it's when you're in an environment where there's a lot of coercive control, where there's abuse, where there's domination, where there's power and control issues going on. If your gut tells you something's wrong, whether you're a kid, when you're a kid, you can't always control your environment. But when you're an adult, in any situation, even walking down the street, if somebody, something, some environment feels wrong to you, usually trust your gut. And that's a cliche saying, but neurologically, we got a lot of neurological stuff going on in our actual digestive system. So it literally falls into that stuff. But, you know, your instincts sometimes can lead you true when your heart and your head sometimes don't always. It's about finding a wisdom inside yourself. And the other thing is, you know, something that I didn't do a lot up until recently, for a lot of reasons, was try to seek out support from people. And it doesn't necessarily have to be people who also grew up in the environment you did, or were in a cult, or were whatever. You know, I have made several friends with people from the Truth and Justice group that I participated in, who just in making friends with them, I've realized I have so much in common with. And whether it's a literal support group, because I'm hoping that, you know, the relatively unscathed, I'm also going to be making a website with information about PTSD and resources and books and all that, you know.
Yeah, whatever, I think that's a
blog
idea,
if you will. What I was saying was that, you know, seek out support from people who make you feel like you can do it, like you're good the way you are, like we'll be there for you. The problem is sometimes those groups can become weird. Trust your gut, because that was what that group was for my mom. Somewhere she felt safe, she felt good. But as soon as those feelings start to change, seek out support. You know, there's a whole, we're going to do episodes on Relatively Unscathed about domestic violence, but there are, you know, steps to take to help yourself. But overall, the resources we have, I'm going to start crying. The Wizard of Oz was my favorite movie as a kid. And I used that analogy a lot in therapy with kids. And I, you know, sometimes I wear red shoes just to remind myself that the things that you need in life are inside of you. You know, yes, we need other people to help us find them and to put us on paths and to help us realize it. But all therapists do is help you realize your own strengths. You know, and it doesn't even have to be therapy. It can be a group of buddies. It can be a softball team. People who make you feel like you're good the way you are, that you're loved unconditionally, seek out support from those people. But always remember that, you know, the resources you have are there. you got them, you got to learn to use them. And some of us struggle, you know, I struggle with things, but
absolutely,
you know, remember that, you know, the ruby slippers, you know, she could always get home because, you know, those, yeah, she had them. So sorry, I got off track.
No, I love it. I love it. So if people want to reach out to you, how can people get in contact with you?
Well, I'm starting to try to do social media good. I'm trying to do it good. But I do still participate from time to time in the Truth and Justice group.
Yep.
So, and Kelly Deasy is my name there. And I started a Facebook page for the podcast, the eventual podcast. It's called At The Relatively Unscathed. On Twitter, on Instagram, it's pretty much Relatively Unscathed everywhere, or Kelly Deasy, usually different things, but
and the letters DZ.
Yeah, that's a part of how you spell my last name. Yeah. but mostly, if you literally, you can find me anywhere at Relatively Unscathed. You know, and as I keep, when I get the premiere date or whatever the hell you guys want to call it, launch date of the podcast, I will be better at promoting things. But I don't want to say, oh, I'm going to do it on this date and then not have the audio abilities.
Well, when you get it ready, please let me know, and I will make sure I tell my listeners.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Zach, and I really appreciate you reaching out and giving me this opportunity to get more comfortable talking behind the microphone.
Well, I'm happy you joined me today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Do you hear that too?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to stop? We can hear the air conditioner.
Yeah. It's all right.
Okay.